Hello, and welcome to the Movie Spotlight on the Comic Book Page podcast. My name is John Mayo. In this episode, we'll have a spoiler-filled discussion about a movie we think you'll enjoy. In this episode, I am joined by my sister Kay, and we're going to have a spoiler-filled discussion on the Pacific Rim movie from 2013. Now, I wanted to watch this originally, and I did watch it originally. We just rewatched it because it's essentially Power Rangers for grown-ups.
I like that description.
You take the premise of Power Rangers and do basically a non-kids show, serious action summer blockbuster movie take on it. You've got these giant alien monsters coming. You've got people in full body suits with helmets, coordinated attacks as in the head of the giant robot, smacking it down. Mm-hmm. So the only things they would have to change to turn it into a Power Ranger movie had they wanted to.
Rainbow colors.
Rainbow colors and teenagers with attitude.
There you go.
And they had one kid with an attitude.
Definitely.
I enjoyed this. I thought it was fun. There were a couple of places it was a little messy because, well, they're ripping the aliens limb from limb.
I was impressed that even CG gore is gory.
Yeah. There were a few things in this movie because we get a opening scene where we've got the two brothers piloting the robot. One dies. The other, you know, survives. And then cut to what, 5-6 years later.
5 years later.
And now they're only, you know, out of the entire Jaeger army of robots, 4 left. And we see 2 of them get destroyed before too long. And of course, you commented as they're going into action, wondering if the lifespan of the pilots is directly proportional to the amount of dialogue they had had before.
It was a good, fair, honest question.
And an accurate assessment.
Well, what made me ask the question was we had 2 teams out of the 4 of pilots. They really had had no dialogue. I mean, they'd had reaction shots. They'd been introduced. We'd seen them on camera.
They never spoke.
Exactly. But then we cut to the interior of one of the Jaeger heads, and we've got the 2 pilots in their armor. Yes. And they're speaking Russian.
Notably, I don't remember the Hong Kong guys' helmets, but the Russian ones had, like, visors that came down, but they were not full face masks.
Well, and they had these red cyborg eyes.
What got me about the lack of a full face mask, though, is they're the ones who drowned.
Yes.
They're the ones that would have benefited from the full oxygen astronaut suit look.
There is that, too. Well, each of them have one red eye.
Yeah.
Which I thought was interesting. But yeah, they start speaking a little bit in Russian, and it dawns on me, this is the first time we've heard their voices. And I don't think that bodes well for them.
We still hadn't heard the 3-man team. And they made a to-do during the tour of the Shatter Dome. And I'm like, wow, that's what I want my headquarters to be called. Shatter anything. I mean, just domes, fine. I got nothing against domes, but
this is the highly breakable dome in which we have decided to make our headquarters and feel safe.
Yes, I want my fortress to be brittle. But the 3-man team during that tour was highlighted of, oh, they've got this unusual 3-man team, extra arm or whatever.
And a special technique they're famous for.
We never see the technique.
Actually, they say, now let's do, and they name that technique
again.
Fair enough.
We get the technique. We see the buzz saws on the hands spin, but they never really do much technique because they die pretty quick.
Well,
and I'd never got a good shot of the interior of that one to see how they did it.
No, I didn't feel we got a good shot of the interior of that one. And when we started to get to see the 3 arms in motion, we cut away before I could really see what the to-do was. Because one of the arms seemed to kind of be on the backside. And I'm like, so is the torso section going to spin around? What's going to happen here?
It looked like the robot had 2 right arms.
Yeah.
And 1 left. Now, you would think after the thing where they lost a pilot and basically now you can only control, I guess, all of it or half of it. I don't know. It just seemed like having a redundant right arm was good unless the guy on the left was taken out.
Well, their whole thing was no one person is strong enough to handle a Jaeger. And they were saying only two pilots have ever done solo combat because of that.
Exactly. The one who survived that we follow throughout this, and the one who had re-recruited him was the other guy.
Yeah.
And it seemed like with the Mark I's, maybe they did solo pilots for the few who could handle it.
See, I couldn't tell if he had been a solo pilot or if he'd had a similar, his pilot died for some reason. I didn't feel they were clear enough on that.
True. They could have been clear.
You know, I mean, it was obvious he was sick early on. The radiation poisoning made sense as an explanation. Mm-hmm. The willingness to do whatever, to sacrifice himself for others, made sense in light of the, he's dying anyways. He wants a good and noble death.
Yes. Yes. And it's also why he's so passionate about the program.
Yes.
Of the Jaegers.
The memory sequence.
In the drift.
In the drift with Mako. Mm-hmm. And that same drift pilot or Jaeger pilot when he rescued her. What cracked me up there is you've got this little girl who looks to be 5 or 6 looking up at this Jaeger who seems to be how many stories tall of a building?
I'm going to say at least 30.
See? All right. And this man climbs out of the top of it like the top of a submarine.
With the sun directly behind him.
Yes, and she smiles in relief that he's come to rescue. How did he get down from the top of that to rescue her?
How did she see him on the top of that thing? Fair amount of distance away, fair height, and the sun directly behind him.
Yeah, I mean, I'll buy that she saw a human silhouette and felt relief. I mean, I can kind of get that. That her adult mind replace the child's memory with, we know who it is, so I can put the face in there. But I just kept trying to work on, how'd he get down to her?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I wanted the Jaeger's hand to lift her up to the shoulder.
Much like they'd lifted the boat at the beginning.
Yes.
Which that right there gives a sense of scale.
Yes.
It picked up a 10-man boat in its hand.
Like it was a little bathtub toy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I did like how at the beginning when we see Gypsy Danger and they were doing the walking, it did look very mechanical. And I'm like, well, that's kind of odd. But they did point out later that these were analog ships or robots or whatever.
Yeah.
It was all what you physically do it picks up on, which is weird because there's clearly a computer hookup that they're interfacing with.
Mm-hmm.
So they did play a little fast and loose of, is it analog or is it digital?
There seemed to be multiple things going on in terms of there seemed to be aspects of it that were controlled by the neural link. They seemed to have to physically control aspects of it, like they were walking in the head. And I was joking to you at one point, you know, some of the dance sequences, some simply of the movement sequences for the Jaegers were like synchronized dance.
And that's one of the other things that kind of reminds me of the Power Rangers, where they've got to do the synchronized moves to more for this, that, or the other. Whenever they're all in the cockpit doing the, okay, let's take him down with the sword, they're all doing the striking motion and stuff like that. Granted, there's like 5 or 12, depending on the ship, but or the Zord. But here, there's just the 2 or the 3.
Well, and the teams, Mako and Riley, I guess was his name, that were together the longest, the Striker family. Mm-hmm. That was together the longest. They were good. The actors had clearly worked together on syncing up the motions and stuff. But then at the end of the movie, you get to a team that's kind of had to be thrown together because of an injury. And I noticed when they were filming that, you would get a headshot of one guy when they're in motion or a headshot of the other guy when they're in motion. And I was kind of these two actors didn't have time to sync up the motions.
Well, the two characters didn't. The actors had the same time everybody else did.
Presumably, but one of those actors was busy with the other one, making sure he had synced it up.
Fair enough, fair enough. I just figure filming a movie takes a while.
2-3 months.
Yeah.
You know, but I think it's one of those things where I think two actors syncing it up was hard enough.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it comes down to how much time do you have to shoot those scenes and how much else do you got going on.
Yeah.
I liked how they had different armaments for the robots. The robots had personalities of sorts, you know, and they had everything from like the elbow rocket to get the stronger punch.
I liked that. Yeah.
They took a fairly, you know, realistic-ish view of these giant robots, and the effects held up.
Yes. Yes. I remember watching it when it was originally out, in part because a lot of people had said, basically, plot-wise, it's a bit light and fluff, but...
It's a disaster film in a plot.
You know, but it was a fun roller coaster ride. And they're like, if you just go in for fun entertainment, not looking for deep plot, you're going to have a good time watching it.
Well, the basic plot is there's a rift in the Pacific Ocean to another dimension. Giant monsters are coming through, wrecking havoc. We must destroy them or be destroyed.
I believe one of your early comments was, why wasn't Tokyo the first city hit?
Yeah, because the first attack was on San Francisco. I'm like, if you're doing a giant monster movie with robots.
Yes.
I mean, they gave Hong Kong a good shout out. They didn't really give the Japanese their due.
That's very true.
This is, in my mind, a Japanese genre.
Yeah, yeah.
Not to say others can't do it, but they're the ones who've originated it and been running with it for decades. I mean, the Super Sentai stuff is going on now 42 years. This was done 5 years ago, so even then, 37 years. Not to say it was original with the Super Sentai stuff. It was not. I think it goes further back, obviously, with Godzilla, etc.
Well, and there was one scene, and I forget what happened, but I remember thinking, you know, that feels very Godzilla.
You know, I'm curious, because the kaiju stuff is clearly the Godzilla stuff, but I'm curious what is kind of the originating giant robot with pilots versus a giant monster.
Oh, interesting.
And it may be Godzilla versus Mechagodzilla, but I don't know if Mechagodzilla had pilots or if it was just a robotic thing or what.
Yeah.
But it was, let's see, Go Ranger was 1975. It went for 3 years, had another series. 77 was the Spider-Man one. Actually, I'm going to say the Japanese Spider-Man show would have been in the Super Sentai genre, even though it's not technically Super Sentai, the original giant robot, giant monster fight.
Hmm.
Because he had Leopardon or whatever, the giant robot he had. And prior to that, the two Sentai shows before it, which was Go Ranger and Jakka, J-A-K-Q, which is a playing card motif, didn't have the giant robots. It was when they went to Battle Fever J, which was kind of a Captain America riff, that they had that and became Super Sentai. And they later kind of grandfathered in the other two shows as part of the legacy. Both the Spider-Man, obviously, and the Battle Fever J were co-productions with Marvel.
Oh, interesting.
So I'm not sure what predates that in terms of this genre of, you know, piloted giant robots versus monsters.
Yeah.
There have been other movies that have tried to do a riff on this. There was one, I'm going to say, man, I don't remember when it was done. I'm going to say the 90s, but I could be a decade off either way. And it was Robot Jocks. It was a post-apocalyptic thing, and you had giant robots, no monsters, and they would duke it out.
Oh,
and the guy from Alien Nation, who went on to be in one of the Star Trek TV shows, Gary Graham?
Yes.
He was the lead in
the movie. Oh, interesting.
And its effects, not so good. Not horrible, but
yeah.
At the time, they were doing what they could, and it was not a major motion picture summer blockbuster. It was just a movie.
Well, I think part of what really helped Pacific Rim catch was they put the money and the effort into both the effects and the CG for the monsters.
Yes.
The fact that on the writing side, when they realized, from my assumption point of view, they realized, okay, the plot, not detailed, not intricate, but if the characters have enough going on in terms of Mako has a backstory that's interesting, Riley has a backstory that's interesting, they have reason to interact the way they do mm-hmm. with the commander in terms of their backstory connects to him. He brought them there for a personal reason, not just a professional reason. The Stryker father-son duo has more going on than just fighting for their country and fighting the monsters. So the characters were all interesting and just complex enough you wanted to stay with them.
They were fairly developed.
Yeah.
And the other thing that helped and prevented it from just being alien giant animals are coming and wrecking havoc, but realizing, no, there's an intelligence on the other side directing this. And there's a method to their madness. It's a bigger threat than we first thought.
Yeah, the two scientists worked out surprisingly well.
It would be like if you had a asteroid's going to destroy the Earth movie, and partway through you realize this was actually a bullet fired by an alien civilization at us.
Yeah.
You know, and they probably fired more than one or something. That raises it to another level beyond just the typical asteroid disaster movie, or in this case, a typical monster movie.
Yeah. Well, and the scientists that decided to try drifting with the portion of an alien brain,
mm-hmm.
you know, the moment he says he's going to do that, based on what we know about drifting, in terms of you share memories back and forth.
But it was when Ron Perlman's character was pointing out to him very clearly, it's a two-way street, you moron.
You genius moron.
Yes. There were aspects of Ron Perlman's character who was a salvager of these carcasses.
Yeah.
And selling them on the black market. He was just chewing up the scenery.
Oh, he was amazing. And when he's pointing out to the genius scientist, he's like, you just told me these aliens are a hive mind. And you're a supposed genius fighting them. Who went on a two-way communication street yeah. with them. And you can't figure out why they changed their battle tactics and are coming straight towards where you and I are standing.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, it was beautiful.
Well, and also the scene where we first get the two scientists in their lab or whatever, and they're just at each other's throats or whatever. There's an aspect of the writing where they toss in inherent character dynamic and conflict
mm-hmm.
beyond just the overall plot.
Well, and what I loved there is so often science has two competing theories.
Yeah, but they took it a step further than that and implied a backstory to those two. You know, none of this stuff on my side of the lab.
Yes.
You shut up, I'm talking now, kind of.
Yeah.
It's not just their opposing sides, but it was also interesting. They're solo scientists. Neither had assistants.
Yes. Well, neither came across as plays well with others.
Agreed.
And I thought that really worked right from the start in terms of each of them was annoyed with the other for their lack of people skills.
But imagine if they had had handlers as assistants in their to them.
Yes.
And their job was basically to keep those two from killing each other.
Yes, yes.
I mean, it would have been funny to have assistants that seemed to be also at each other's throat to do kind of the proxy war or whatever. The scientists go out, and then these two, you realize they're actually lovers, and they, you know, or something like that, and
yeah.
they're play acting because it's their job.
Well, by the time we got to the end, and these two scientists were both determined to figure out the truth.
Yes.
What part of their theory was right? Because they were starting to realize they hadn't gotten it all right. Neither was ready to say they were wrong.
Well, they realized the other side has something going for it because the one guy had predicted the double event. The other guy had drifted with the aliens. So.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it gives that plot twist at the end of this plan you have isn't going to work.
Yeah.
You've got to tweak it on the fly or whatever.
Yeah. And the way they tweaked it on the fly worked for me going down. But if we needed the alien DNA barcode to go both directions, how did the escape pods make it back?
There is that question, and not having seen escape pods prior to that.
Yes.
There's a few things I think they could have touched up on the script there. The other thing that bothered me was in that final battle when they're going into the breach. They quickly lose the arm.
Yes.
So our ace Mach 3 Jaeger pilot is known for having lost the arm limb on his robot twice.
Well, he's now lost both arms.
I was going to say. Yeah.
Yes.
And they also wind up having the leg damage. So at one point, they're basically, you know, crawling or whatever. And when they were using the sword as kind of that walking cane or whatever, it worked up until they had to grab the carcass and ditch the sword or whatever, or decommission the sword. And when they had the sword first come out, when they're almost in space up there, and it's got the segmented thing and it tightens up, straight out of Super Sentai.
I liked that. I mean, I was a little surprised that the alien was flying them up towards space, but okay, we kind of said that the aliens had come back during the time of dinosaurs, so I wasn't totally surprised by a flying one.
The fact it hadn't flown prior to that and the wings just seemed to pop out bothered me a little.
But yeah.
Okay. I forget which Red Ranger had the segmented sword that he could either use as a sword or kind of, you know how it's on that chain or thread or whatever. Loosen it up and use it as a whip.
I was going to say, that's what this looked like.
Yeah.
And it was an interesting effect.
Well, and they did a better job in the robots here with how they worked, how the parts were, what came out of where, whatever, than, say, the Transformer movies.
Yes. And they did a good job of making sure to seal so we're watertight before going all the way submerged.
Begs the question, why not always seal? But okay. You'd be better proof against the acid they shoot. Not that they had shot it before.
Well, they mentioned the acid up the Kaiju Blue up in the beginning section.
You're right. You're right.
The very long opening documentary style.
But when the Russians got hit by it, they're like, it's some sort of acid. Like it was a surprise. And they've been around the block.
I agree.
So there's a few things there they could have cleaned up.
Well, they did say that the Kaiju were evolving.
Well, and how each one was unique. It's not like we've seen the same one twice or whatever. Why they have categories and not, like, classifications. And it seemed like every time they were a significant step up either in size or something, they'd go to another category. Because the Category 5 at the end was the first ever seen.
Yeah. Well, but like one of the Category 4s that came through was the first one to ever be able to do the EMP effect.
Mm-hmm. Again, they're being genetically created on the other side and pumped through. So it's a cat and mouse game.
Yeah.
You get a defense against something and they're going to devise. It begs the question, though, as to how the aliens got any information back when their kaijus would come over, destroy, get killed, and that's it.
But we were able to communicate through the open gateway.
So you think they were essentially having the equivalent of a drift with their aliens, i.e. monitoring the kaiju as it went?
Yeah, somehow they were monitoring it. Because I was shocked when we were able to monitor Mako's oxygen level after they went through, etc. I thought once we knew that they had gone through that...
It seemed like they dropped off the radar at that point.
And yet we were still getting information.
Yeah, yeah. It was unclear what data went through the rift.
Mm-hmm. Well, he was still relaying that he couldn't do the automatic auto-destruct. He was having to go and do the manual, and they were getting confirmation of that.
So clearly radio frequency or some sort of telemetry was going through.
Yeah.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about that, but totally accurate. Your assessment is correct. Whether that's accurate to how an alien reached to another dimension works, I honestly don't know.
Well, but it surprised me that that's how the breach would work, because to me, it didn't make sense.
The fact the question never came up of would they be able to communicate them when they went through, little surprising.
I think that goes back to the hive mind.
For them on the other side, the hive mind explains how they could communicate back. The fact that at Shatterdome, nobody had said when somebody goes through, I mean, they were going to send a bomb originally, but they realized they were going to send a Jaeger through.
Yeah.
Geez, are we going to be able to communicate? Well, let's find out. I mean, a dialogue line or two could have answered that.
When Mako and Riley were planning to go through, there was no line of dialogue to imply anything other than this is a one-way trip.
Yeah.
It sure sounded like a suicide mission right up until he put her in the mysterious escape pod I didn't know was there.
Yes, and that's where setting up the escape pods earlier would have been nice.
Yeah.
Even if it had been when the two guys who'd fought together once before were talking, last time we'd seen each other was when we were fishing so-and-so out of the water.
Yes.
You know, in that joint mission. R2 survived, his didn't, kind of thing.
Yeah.
There's stuff that a line or two of dialogue could have easily kind of closed the loop on.
Yeah, I agree.
But I just don't think writers, generally speaking, go through their last edit and say, is this as tight as it can be? Is it?
Well, the other thing is the Russians who drowned in theirs because they were in a Mach 1. If somebody had muttered, you know, damn, if they were in any version after where the escape pods had been added.
Or the full face masks with oxygen.
You're still caught on that. But I'm just saying.
That would have been interesting to get a clear sense of what the difference between the Mach 1, the Mach 2, the Mach 3, and the Mach 4. Yeah. Well, all the way up to the Mach 5.
Because
of which there was the one.
I mean, the triplets. Did they have escape pods? Why didn't they do something?
Well, and it seems like that one had to be custom built for the three.
Yeah.
And when Mako was asked about how many drops she'd done or whatever, I guess that was in a simulation.
It was.
The fact that we never saw the simulation was a little disconcerting.
Yeah.
Because they also could have used that to be showing how they would design mechs suited for the type of combat the particular pilots were going to do.
Yeah.
It also begs the question of, did Jaegers ever get turned over across pilots? Or was it, this is your robot?
I assumed the Gypsy Danger had gone to someone after Riley and his brother. That's part of why it had been rebuilt.
I took it as they were finishing up the rebuild of it.
Interesting.
Well, and they presumably specifically because this guy was getting re-recruited.
Interesting. I mean, they were totally unclear on that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And again, roller coaster ride, it doesn't impact the ride, but when you stop and think about it, a lot of questions start to come up.
Yeah.
Which is fine. Most movies are that way. But I do think that's kind of the sign between a good movie and a great movie.
Yeah.
Is when they get to that good movie and they go back through it, ask these questions, do some subtle tweaks. Because really, most of the things we've talked about, with the addition of like 2 minutes more of dialogue, could have fixed.
Yes.
So I don't think it's that hard. It's just they usually don't do that kind of a pass. They don't feel the need for it, I guess.
Well, just looking at the characters and who could come back now that we know there's a second movie.
Mm-hmm.
We have Riley.
Yep.
Obviously not his brother.
Obviously not.
I did tease you, I believe, before they even showed the title of the movie that the movie was over because it looked like the two brothers were dead.
Yeah, when we get to the end of the thing and he's fallen out flat after surviving his brother's death and we pull back and get to the opening credits, you were joking that. And I'm like, yeah, I'd have actually put the end, rolled some credits, let the theater clear out and then show the rest of the movie.
Well, I mean, he's laying there on his back on the beach like, you know, that's as far as I can go. I'm done.
Mm-hmm.
Like, so the movie looks over.
It would actually be funny to do that sort of like a trilogy of movies in one sitting. Each movie is more like, you know, 36 minutes or 45 or, you know, whatever.
I have never shown you Amazon Women on the Moon, but I need to. It's a hilarious movie where most of the movie is interrupted by other things.
Ah. Yeah.
Let's see. Mako survived.
Mm-hmm.
But the leader, Marshall, did not. Did we get a surname? I thought Marshall was actually a rank.
Marshall something Pentecost.
There you go. Striker from that, Jaeger Striker. The son did not survive, but the father did.
Father did. He was played by Max Martini from The Unit.
Uh-huh.
He did a good job.
He did a really good job. The two Russians did not survive.
No. The three Hong Kong guys didn't survive.
I know. Short life. The two scientists did.
Yes. And the Elvis dude running the show.
Yes.
The command center guy.
Yes. And amazingly enough, so did Ron Perlman.
Yes, he could come back.
But you only know that if you stayed through the credits.
Yes. Where's my shoe? Because it's funny because the one scientist who drifted with the thing is going to find another brain. So he goes to the Ron Perlman character. The new kaiju dual attack happens.
Perlman
throws the guy out.
You just proved it was a science fiction / fantasy movie by saying the character went searching for another brain.
Yes. But Perlman throws the scientist out to go to a public bunker because, you know, he didn't do Perlman's character didn't do well the one time he went to one.
Okay, in the public shelter, the scientist proves what genius he is.
Because the kaiju is targeting him.
And he announces it to the people in the shelter.
Yeah, at first, the shelter is full and he's dead center. It's like, well, it's pretty crowded, I'm thinking. And then he's like, yeah, they're looking for me. And then suddenly there's like a 20-foot radius around them. Everybody's like huddled up against the wall.
Yes.
But this guy survives that attack because now the monster has to go after the other robot.
The kaiju comes through the roof right at him.
Yes. So, one attack. And then we realize after that one's dead, that it's pregnant. The baby comes out and attacks and winds up dying after almost, but not quite, getting to said scientist.
But don't worry, the scientist curled up in a fetal position to get away from a baby.
Yes. And I'm like, dude, that guy is so lucky. He survived two kaiju attacks. And then Perlman's character, oh, I knew that thing wouldn't survive. Rants about that for about 30 seconds before the baby kaiju essentially wakes back up, swallows him, and then keels back over.
Oh, gosh.
And I'm like, three kaiju attacks?
Yes.
What are the odds?
Yes.
So they did some fun stuff with that. It had a sense of humor about it, but it managed to take the admittedly absurd premise seriously.
Yeah. Well, and it understood the need for comic relief because you can't just keep building the tension.
I think you could take almost any premise that has been played for laughs in some sort of a story and say, okay, let's identify clearly the premise and let's take it serious. Mm. I mean, you could do that for anything, even like the Roadrunner Coyote cartoons.
Yeah.
And it'd be a stretch. It'd be a dark film, I think. Live action or something. I don't know. But again, there's so many of these things that are hallmarks of the Power Ranger Super Sentai franchise. You know, you've got the mentor back at the base. Mm-hmm. You've got, again, the robots, all that kind of stuff. And the hand-to-hand combat for training.
Yes.
The fact they never really seemed to use it much. The other thing that surprised me is when they had the large ship they were using as a melee weapon at one of those. I'm like, you're building these robots from scratch and you don't give them the equivalent of a quarterstaff? That's what they train with.
Yeah. I was thinking about all the property damage the Jaegers do with utter and complete disregard. We're here to save you, but not your property.
Well, they're not going to worry about collateral damage when the fate of the world's at stake. I get that.
Oh, yeah.
The part that got me was at one point when the robot was getting pushed back through a building. He wasn't really getting stuck in the building. The building was almost a breakaway building.
Yes. I thought you were on the time the fist went through a single story of an office building.
That was a little ridiculous. When it stops right at somebody's desk that's got one of those hanging balls that do the perpetual motion thing, yes. And it's just enough force to start it. And then the fist cleanly comes out.
Yes.
It's like it didn't get stuck.
Yes. And now we know the size of a fist. One story of a building.
I don't think so, because that doesn't match that same robot's against the fishing trawler.
I can't disagree with you, but that's what I saw.
And these things seem like they'd be pretty heavy, yet they're light enough that it only takes a handful of helicopters to cart them around.
That's true.
The part I never understood was the pilots would get into the head. The head would descend some great distance to the robot.
To me, that felt very Batman going down to the Batcave.
It did, but when you get to that command center, and it was at, I'm going to say, elbow-ish height on the robot, because when they've got the thing about to shoot the thing, that's what it was. So the head's going to be even higher up. And it had to descend from a great distance.
Yes.
So if you're a pilot and you're leaving the command center, you've got to go hit this elevator to go way up.
And across.
To then go across, to get into your thing, to then drop down. Mm-hmm. So why have the head detach at all? Now, your theory was that it would be interchangeable heads.
Yeah. Your head could go to others of the same model.
They only had a few different models, and most of the ones we saw were from different models, so that doesn't make sense.
At this base.
At this base. And two, all the heads looked fairly different. They didn't look interchangeable. Plus, and maybe it's a Mark III and before thing, you had the analog controls with the rest of the body, so you'd have to have a fairly standardized interface.
Yeah.
Don't know. The mind boggles.
So many questions come up when you stop and think about the roller coaster ride.
I know. It was still a fun film.
It was very fun.
I can see why it did well. I can see why they wanted to make a sequel out of it. They've done some comics through Legendary, which I've read, both back then and more recently. And they're good. They're not, oh my God, brilliant, but they're good. There's an aspect of this where it loses some of the dynamic nature of it. When you go from a live-action CG film...
I can see that.
...to the comic book page.
I can see it being hard to capture the sense of the roller coaster ride on the page.
It's hard to capture that, and you've got to have a fairly solid artist that can really convey that kind of action stuff. Because it's one of those things where when you've got somebody who's used to doing superhero actions, they can do the regular type stuff. Mm. It takes another level of effort to scale that to where it looks like a giant robot doing it. And frankly, as sales are not brilliant compared to where they were, you know, back in the past, and page rates are higher because cost of living's higher, etc., it's hard to find the people who've got the talent at an affordable page rate.
Yeah, I can see that. One of the things I liked here was kind of the synchronized round control on one hand when they were controlling one hand. At one point when the brother was taken out,
mm-hmm.
and Riley's left hand had been injured, he had to get his right hand over to the left arm to force the control to switch to the right arm.
It took some effort for him to get the controller on his arm that was still good, but the robot's arm was not.
Yeah.
To control the other side of the robot.
Yeah.
So it was...
There was some good stuff in there.
They gave it some thought, and I think whoever put together how the cockpit worked and that, both in terms of the set and the effects and stuff, they did a good job. They sold the concept.
Well, and honestly, the first time they used the submarine hatch at the top of the head for getting out in the middle of combat, I liked it.
I would have liked it better if we had seen them actually go up a ladder on the inside.
Yes, I'll agree with that.
Because it did kind of beg the question as to, wait, where exactly is that?
Yeah, and there was no concrete, this is just how they come and go, because there seemed to be more of a straight out door at the back when they came in.
Yeah, a back door to the head.
Yeah. So, but yeah, that played surprisingly well for me when we saw it having been used.
Again, having seen dozens of interior cockpits to giant robots through the Super Sentai and Power Ranger franchise, this was a more detailed mechanical sort of approach, but it was also very much in line with conceptually what they've done in the Super Sentai franchise. So this was fun. Good action stuff. The plot held together. It was not just we've got a giant monster. Let's go fight the one. Because typically that would be a lose, draw, go beat it up kind of a thing.
Yes.
Standard Jackie Chan fight progression. And here we had enough different monsters to go through. It was fun.
Yeah, it was.
Is there anything else on this one?
I think that does it.
Cool.
The show notes and forum for this podcast can be found at www.comicbookpage.com under the podcast and forum sections of the website. Please email us at theguys@comicbookpage.com and let us know what you think of what was discussed in this episode. Thanks for listening.